We think of the Bible as one big book when actually it's a library of 66 books written by more than 40 authors over a period of 1,500 years. There are books that are about law, about history, about sex, about poetry, about prophecy, about theology. It's a library that has this vast array. Some of the information is absolutely fascinating. And some of the Bible is actually kind of boring. Some of it is funny. Some of it is tragic. And some of it is rated R. And we wonder, why is this dark side of human behavior so graphically written into the Bible? The answer is because it actually happened. That biblical heroes are not photoshopped so that all of their imperfections and sins are deleted. Even godly heroes like David are exposed for their ungodly behavior. In our journey through the biblical biography of David, there are chapters that include bloody murder and civil war, lying and intrigue and dirty politics. I just need to say, I didn't write it. I don't take responsibility for the content, that I just report it. And I also have to admit that sometimes it's difficult to read out loud in public some of the things that are included in the pages of the Bible. We pick up this story of King David in 2 Samuel chapter 2. It was a time when the pagan Philistines had devastatingly defeated the army of Israel. The king was dead, the infrastructure was significantly damaged, the country was in disarray, and the nation was rushing towards civil war. 2 Samuel chapter 2 says that in the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" he asked. The Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, "The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul, your master, by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul, your master, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Judah was one of the 12 provinces, the 12 states of the ancient nation of Israel, and Judah was David's home state. With the country in shambles, with everything in disarray, David asked God where he should go, and he was directed to a small city in his home state that was called Hebron. He moved there with his small army, and the leaders of his state decided to crown him the king, not of the entire nation of Israel, but only of this state of Judah. So at last, David was actually a king over half a country. Actually, it wasn't even a half a country. It was 1/12 of a country. With the crown on his head, it is interesting to see what he did. Actually, interesting to see what any political leader, when they finally get power, do. And some of the first things they do are most interesting and sometimes most telling. The first royal act was that David gave a special blessing to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. There were men from there who had, at risk of their own lives, attacked a pagan Philistine fortress in order to retrieve the bodies of killed King Saul and his three sons, and brought those bodies back to their little town of Jabesh-Gilead, where they honored them and where they buried them. And David wanted to acknowledge this. It was a way of honoring his former king and mentor and friend. But it was also a politically savvy thing for him to do, because Jabesh-Gilead was not in his home state and now his kingdom of Judah. It was actually in a different territory, and it was a way of honoring the king of that territory and seeking the favor of those who lived there, with the hope that someday they also would become part of his kingdom. However, the crowning of David triggered a civil war, a gruesome and long civil war between these provinces, 11 of them to the north and Judah to the south. With the king of the north dead, the general of the army did what often happens in political disarray. The army took over. The general's name was Abner, and he set up a puppet king. It was the 40-year-old surviving son of the former king, Saul, and he was crowned King Ishbosheth. Doesn't really have a ring to it, but he was the king nonetheless, although he served only for 2 years. With the Philistines occupying so much of his country, he couldn't even go back to the capital city and had to establish a new capital. But worse yet, civil war was coming, and it broke out at a place called the Pool of Gibeon. The recently defeated army of Israel faced the courageous little army of Judah. General Abner led the army of Israel, and General Joab led the army of Judah. Rather than have an all-out battle between these two armies, Abner said to Joab, "Let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand-to-hand in front of us." "All right, let them do it," Joab said. So they stood up and were counted off. 12 men for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 for David. Then each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's side, and they fell down together. So that place in Gibeon was called Helkath Hazarim. It was kind of like the American Civil War, when brother was fighting against brother and cousin was fighting against cousin. This was Jew fighting against Jew. They should have been focusing on their enemy, the pagan Philistines, but instead they were killing each other. And what was in mind here was that rather than have them just slaughter each other, have great casualties, and have animosity going into future generations, they would have 12 champions, sort of like with David and Goliath, 12 champions that would fight it out together. They ended up all killing each other, and then the battle spread to everyone else. The fight could not be contained. So that by the end of the day, General Abner's army had lost 360 of their soldiers, and General Joab's army had lost 19. The battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated by David's men. When this battle was over, both of these armies started to head home. But something happened. There was one guy in the army of Judah who just wouldn't let it go. His name was Asahel, and he was kind of like, you know, there's some people like this today. There's a fight, the fight's over, it's clear who's won, and they just won't drop it. They just won't let it go. They just keep fighting yesterday's battles. And this fast-running young soldier decided all by himself that he was going to chase down General Abner and kill him. It was a foolish decision. Abner was a veteran soldier. He had been in lots of battles, and he knew how to fight very well. But Asahel kept going after him. He just wouldn't let it go. He chased Abner, turning neither to the right nor to the left as he pursued him. Abner looked behind him and asked, "Is that you, Asahel?" "It is," he answered. Then Abner said to him, "Turn aside to the right or to the left. Take on one of the young men and strip him of his weapons." But Asahel would not stop chasing him. Again, Abner warned Asahel, "Stop chasing me. Why should I strike you down? How could I look your brother Joab in the face?" But Asahel refused to give up the pursuit. So Abner thrust the butt of his spear into Asahel's stomach, and the spear came out through his back. He fell there and died on the spot. And quite frankly, it wasn't Abner's fault. He tried to stop him. He tried to talk him out of it. He didn't want there to be any more bloodshed. And especially he didn't want to fight this young man, because this young man was the brother of the general of the opposing army. And it triggered another conflict, because the general of the opposing army was so angry over the death of his brother that he now wanted to kill General Abner in retaliation. And a very bad situation just kept getting worse. Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and as the sun was setting, they came to the hill of Ammah near Gia on the way to the wasteland of Gibeon. Then the men of Benjamin rallied behind Abner. They formed themselves into a group and took their stand on top of a hill. Abner called out to Joab, "Must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize that this will end in bitterness? How long before you order your men to stop pursuing their brothers?" Joab answered, "As surely as God lives, if you had not spoken, the men would have continued the pursuit of their brothers until morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men came to a halt. They no longer pursued Israel, nor did they fight anymore. It was one of those rare and wonderful days when cooler heads prevailed. When in the midst of a battle between brothers, one of them said, "Just stop this. Just stop it. This is crazy. We shouldn't be doing this." And the opponent agreed as well. Because in civil war, sometimes even between those who ought to be on the same side, there is such viciousness and animosity that it ends only in mutual destruction. Cooler heads prevail, at least for one day. The civil war between these competing kings and armies simply wouldn't stop. They should have been fighting against the pagan Philistines, but instead they're killing each other. The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. David's reign was strengthening, and increasingly he acted like a king. Unfortunately, he sometimes acted badly as a king. And so when 2 Samuel chapter 3 begins, there is a list there of the names of 6 sons who were born to David in his new and temporary capital city of Hebron. 6 sons born from David to 6 different women. So he had at least 6 wives. David quickly became a polygamist when that was clearly forbidden by God and by Old Testament law. Laws that had been written down 500 years before David was born and that he had to know very, very well. They say in the Old Testament law of Deuteronomy chapter 17, "When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, 'Let us set a king over us like all the nations around us,' be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray." David knew that. He knew what he was doing was wrong, and he repeatedly did what was wrong and defied and disobeyed God repeatedly. Now, I know that we are prone, when we read stories of polygamy, to interpret them and understand them primarily in sexual terms, and that certainly was part of this. However, it was political as well. In the list of the wives of David is one named Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. So she was a princess of a foreign and a pagan land that was up north. And apparently what David was doing was establishing treaties and partnerships with neighboring nations to strengthen his international relations and his political position in anticipation of the day when he would take over the other 11 states and rule over all of the nation of Israel. But David wasn't the only one who was into power politics. In the northern kingdom, those other 11 states, General Abner was the man who was bringing to himself increasing power and sinful behavior. During the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now Saul had had a concubine named Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why did you sleep with my father's concubine?" Well, that is to say that King Saul, now dead, was also a polygamist. And that General Abner, in charge of the army, looked over the dead king's harem and picked out a concubine that he would then bed. And when he was confronted by the king, he told the king that if you criticize me, I will give your kingdom away. And there may have actually been politics as well as sex in this, because in those days, one of the ways that someone would take over someone else's kingdom was to have sexual relations with the former king's harem or the former king's wives. When Ishbosheth realized the threat that the powerful general would give away his kingdom, then he stopped all criticism and closed his mouth. But Abner realized what was happening. He could see that David, even though he had only the single state of Judah, was getting stronger and stronger and his army better and better. And every time they had conflicts, David and his army seemed always to win. And so General Abner decided that he would sell out his country and his king, whom he had set on the throne. And he did this by sending a secret message to David. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to say to David, "Whose land is it? Make an agreement with me and I will help you bring all Israel over to you." "Well, that's a good idea," David said. "I'll make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, the daughter of Saul, when you come to see me." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, demanding, "Give me my wife, Michal." So what you have here is some more behind-the-scenes politics of these biblical characters. Biblical characters who are wheeling and dealing for their own politics, for their own ambition, for their own sexual lusts, for their own power in the kingdom. Abner offers to turn over these 11 states and just give them to David. And David, knowing this is a really good deal, decides to throw in a condition. And the condition is that he get Michal as his wife. Actually, she had been his wife. She was the daughter of King Saul, and Saul had given her hand in marriage to David, and David and Michal had been very much in love. But King Saul, in his insanity and his anger, one day decided to take his daughter back. And so he took his daughter back and forced her to marry another man. And David, now these years later, says that he wants his wife back again. In one sense, that was, I suppose you would say, very good, but there was perhaps a political motivation here as well. It would mean that the new queen would be the daughter of the past king, and that would help David in his political base when he takes over the rest of the country. So it's politics on top of politics on top of politics. What happened? Well, they seized. Michal took her away from her husband. Her husband, who very publicly wept and cried and begged in order to get her back, and was forced then to go home without her. And she was forced to leave that husband and go back to David. In this story, you do not find a hint that this concubine was ever consulted or that Princess Michal was ever consulted. These women were essentially the pawns of powerful men who took them and did with them as they pleased simply because they had the power to do it. General Abner knew that he was on the losing side. And so he chose high treason against King Ishbosheth and he gave away the kingdom to David. The people that were in political influence were largely from one of the states of this northern kingdom, the state of Benjamin. And General Abner talked to them so that he could persuade them to support the giving away of the kingdom to David. Abner spoke to the Benjamites in person. And then he went to Hebron to tell David everything that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin wanted to do. When Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David at Hebron, David prepared a feast for him and his men. Then Abner said to David, "Let me go at once and assemble all Israel for my lord the king, so that they may make a compact with you and that you may rule over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. At last, the civil war is going to be over, and David is going to be the king over the entire country. Peace was at hand. Well, they thought that the happy days were there again. But then comes General Joab of David's kingdom and army. He was offended because he wasn't consulted in this new political deal. He was still angry because his brother had been killed, although he had been killed by Abner in self-defense, and he wanted revenge. He went to King David and confronted him and said that this treaty was a bad idea and he wanted to undermine it. And when he got nowhere, he pretended to go on a social visit to General Abner. Joab took Abner aside into the gateway as though to speak with him privately. And there, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach and he died. And then that created another political crisis for David. He had struck a deal, had a treaty, merged the two kingdoms together, but it had all been done in a private conversation with General Abner, and now he was dead. So maybe nobody's going to believe this. And then worse yet, there's the risk that the rumor will spread throughout the kingdom to be acquired that David was actually behind this, that David was the one who set Joab on his route toward assassination. And while it wasn't true, there are conspiracy theory people in every generation. That is not something that is new to the 21st century. And so to protect his political process, David quickly went out of his way to show the greatest of respect for Abner and deep remorse over his death and to politically put all the blame on Joab. Later, when David heard about this, here's what he said. "I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, son of Ner. May his blood fall upon the head of Joab and upon his father's house." And then he gives a really eloquent curse that I would like you to forget after you hear it. "May Joab's house never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy, or who leans on a crutch, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks food." Okay, forget that. Then David said to Joab and to all the people with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner." King David himself walked behind the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb, and all the people wept also. And it worked. It worked. All the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on that day, all the people and all Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, son of Ner. These are two chapters in the biography of one of the Bible's most famous of characters. And I read this and I'm just kind of taken back. And then I hear people around us today saying, "Oh, the political intrigue and the partisanship and the stuff that's going on today, it's the worst it's ever been." Are you kidding? What you do is thank God you didn't live in biblical times. Be grateful. I mean, this is easy compared to what they were doing back then. And remember something here. Remember that God had a purpose. God had a plan. That God had promised that David would become the king over a united Israel. And when God sets himself to accomplish his purposes, he accomplishes his purposes. He does it in spite of and sometimes through war and arrogance and murder and rape and marriages and revenge and vicious politics, God accomplishes what God sets out to accomplish. But here's the question for us. Could God have accomplished his purposes without what they did? Is there ever an excuse for us to behave like the pagans? Is there good reason? If we have a good objective, if the political goal is a worthy one, is it okay to be vicious? Is it okay to lie and cheat and steal? Is it okay to manipulate? Are those things all right? If the purpose is good and the end is the right end, and I hope you know the answer. The answer is no. That God can and will accomplish his purposes, and we do not need to contribute our sinful ways in order to accomplish what God wants. Not in politics, not in business, not in family, not in marriage, not in personal relationships. In fact, when we live out God's way, when we have respect and trust and kindness and justice, and when we seek to protect human life, what we are actually doing is making a bold declaration that we believe God really is in charge, that God really does have the power to do what is good and right and to accomplish his purposes, and we don't need to use pagan and sinful ways in order to get the right thing done. So what we do is we trust him. Don't sin in order to do something good. Trust God. He can do this while we do what is right. God, we need to know this, because while we wince at some of the misbehavior of these biblical characters, we know that the temptation is ours and in every generation to try to spin and twist and manipulate, to sin with selfishness and arrogance and ambition to get our way. Give to us, God, a fresh challenge for your way, for accomplishing your purposes, but accomplishing your purposes with justice and love and respect and kindness and confidence and trust in you through Jesus Christ our Lord.